Hi, I'm Chuck Seckinger, and welcome to Labor Relation Gigs in Small Bites. In this podcast, we will concentrate on the union construction market and explain all you need to know to understand the labor relations practices that are so unique to this industry. And we'll do it one step at a time in small bites. So let's go. Hello, and welcome to episode one of Labor Relation Gigs in Small Bites. Today we are going to talk about U.S. labor history, important labor legislation, and the structure of labor unions back in the 1800s to today. We will start back in the mid-1800s when American workers were making the transition from artisans and farmers to wage earners. The European artisan system of master craftsmen, journeymen, and apprentices had the makings of a mutual benefit organization similar to a union. The origins of many U.S. building trades unions started using the same structure. In the artisan model, after 7 years of training in their trades, such as bootmakers, blacksmiths, masons, etc., the apprentice became a journeyman, wage earner, or worked by the piece until they saved enough money to form their own shop. However, things were changing in the early part of the 1800s, and workers were hired to build national infrastructure projects like canals, highways, and railroads. Water-powered factories were built where labor was subdivided, which reduced the skill level and paid lower wages as a result. This tore apart the artisan model and broke the binding relationship between master craftsmen to journeymen to apprentices in some of the trades. The U.S. Industrial Revolution was just starting. Now, the history of unions in the U.S. up until 1842, with the issuance of the Commonwealth versus Hunt decision, had been one of strikes and disruption of businesses, where courts ruled that such collective actions by workers were illegal under conspiracy laws. However, with Commonwealth versus Hunt, the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled for the first time in the country that workers had the right to organize and strike for useful and honorable purposes. But without any laws to carry forward the workers' rights to organize and strike, the labor movement's progress was mired in strikes and violent demonstrations for the next seven decades, like the famous Haymarket Square riot of 1886 in Chicago, the Homestead Strike of 1892 in western Pennsylvania, and the Ludlow Massacre in Colorado in 1914. But in 1914, the U.S. Congress passed the Clayton Act, and it was signed by President Woodrow Wilson, which stated that labor organizations should not be construed to be illegal combinations in restrictive trade under the Sherman Antitrust Law. The Clayton Act barred injunctions against peaceful and lawful strikes. Samuel Gompers, the president of the American Federation of Labor at the time, called the Clayton Act the industrial Magna Carta for working people. With this background foundation laid, let's talk about the origins of the building trades unions in more detail. As I just mentioned, the American Federation of Labor, and under the leadership of Samuel Gompers, the building and construction trades began their origin and growth. Previous to the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, as it was called, the predominant leader of the labor movement was the Knights of Labor, which was a mix of skilled craft unions and unskilled worker unions. The Knights of Labor would be tarnished by the violence of the Haymarket Square riots, and as a result, never really recover its prominency. The AFL became their successor, picking the strongest unions to go forward in a new structure. Whereas the Knights of Labor promoted industrial unionism and big economic and social reforms, the AFL favored a more pragmatic approach by using collective bargaining to always get more for its members at the bargaining table. This was called business unionism, or a bread and butter approach to collective bargaining, with less of the political and social reform movement that prevailed with the Knights of Labor. The AFL advocated for volunteerism through the collective bargaining process. For example, rather than pushing for national health care, the AFL brought the issue to the bargaining table and won health care through collective bargaining agreements with their employers. The 25 skilled craft unions that formed the AFL in 1886 found they could operate with autonomy and unity within their new federation, which was lacking in the old Knights of Labor. The autonomy was to be granted a certain jurisdiction over their skill or craft workforce, and not to be raided by rival unions for their members. They also had the unity among the Federation's affiliated unions when all were faced with a common foe, or pushing for reform like the 8-hour workday. We will talk more about the subject of jurisdiction in greater detail in Episode 2 on jurisdiction. As far as politics, the AFL was far more conservative in their approach to American economic and foreign policy, and in 1906, the Democrats became more interested in the union movement as a base constituent, more than the Republican Party was. It's been that way ever since. However, the exception to the rule would be the building trades unions, who most carefully choose the candidates that best match up with their agenda for labor reforms among the Democrats, Republicans, and independents in the race. The building trades unions in the AFL really came into their own with the advent of the construction of steel-framed skyscraper buildings starting in the 1880s in major American cities like Chicago, New York, and St. Louis. As a result of these new methods of construction, using innovations like high-speed elevators, electric motors, and steam heating systems, many of the building trades unions formed and flourished. Citywide building trades councils were formed, and local unions could afford to have walking delegates that toured each construction site to enforce the union wages and working conditions on the job sites. With the development of these large building trades councils in major cities, a more permanent organization took hold, and in 1908, delegates from 18 trades formed the Building Trades Department within the AFL, which later was renamed the Building and Construction Trades Department, and finally today as the North America's Building Trades Unions, or NABTU. In 1955, under the leadership of their president, George Meade, the AFL merged forces with the Congress of Industrial Organizations, a group of industrial unions in the mining, steel, car production, and other industries, to form the AFL-CIO, which we know today as the recognized leader in the American labor movement. Through that merger in 1955 to today, the building trades unions have kept their autonomy in the AFL-CIO and NABTU, operating under the common banner of representing the 14 separate building trades unions. The big takeaway from this labor history section is that the building trades unions are unified in the AFL-CIO and in NABTU. They believe in collective bargaining process through business unionism, negotiating bread and butter issues like wages, benefits, and working conditions, and not so much the social causes. Next, we will talk about the development of labor laws in the U.S. and how the union's construction market fits into that structure. As I mentioned in the labor history section, the formation of unions in the early 1900s lacked the labor laws that protected the workers' rights to organize, bargain with their employers, and strike. In this section, I will talk about the labor laws that developed in the first half of the 20th century that settled those issues, granting workers the right to organize and form unions and even strike upon impasse. The creation of new labor laws would control industrial relations from the early 1900s to the present day. As America entered into World War I and World War II, the United States war production was threatened by the disruption of worker strikes. the country experimented with two different incarnations of a national or labor board. One initiated in Woodrow Wilson's administration from 1918 to 1919 during World War I, and again another under the Franklin D. Roosevelt administration from 1942 to 1945 during World War II. In both cases, the War Labor Board's purpose was to forestall disruptions in production and arbitrate disputes between workers and employers. These war boards supported the 8-hour day, equal pay for women, and the right to organize unions and bargain collectively. The war board decisions generally supported and strengthened the position of labor. However, they had no coercive enforcement power over employers, but they did work, and the American worker got their first taste of industrial democracy. The Norris LaGuardia Act in 1932 codified the right of workers to join unions and protected their right to self-organize and bargain over wages and other terms and conditions of employment. The Act also barred federal court injunctions against nonviolent labor disputes and banned the use of yellow dog contracts where workers were forced to not join a union as a condition of employment. But the most important piece of legislation for labor was passed 3 years later with the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, also known as the Wagner Act. The National Labor Relations Act was then, and still today, the charter of industrial democracy in the United States. It protects the rights of employees and employers and encourages collective bargaining. Most importantly, it created the National Labor Relations Board for the purpose to enforce employee rights rather than to mediate disputes as the war boards did. The NLRB oversees the union representation process under Section 9A of the Act, by which employees decide whether to be represented by a labor organization or not. This is done by running certified elections within an established bargaining unit, which is determined by the NLRB. It endorses the principle of exclusive representation and majority rule. Also, the NLRB litigates unfair labor practices, claims by the employees or employers, and can initiate investigations, collect evidence, issue subpoenas, and require witnesses to give evidence in these proceedings. During the war years, unions were constrained from striking when it impeded the war effort. However, in 1945, all that changed. Wage increases were held back by the war boards, and now, after the war was over, the unions wanted a greater share of prosperity. In the first 12 months after the war, more than 4,600 strikes swept across the country in mining, shipping, transportation, and manufacturing. With this as a backdrop, the National Labor Relations Act was amended in 1947 with the passage of the Labor Management Relations Act, or Taft-Hartley Act, as it was called, which primarily restricted the activities of labor unions. Its most important feature was the president was authorized to issue an emergency injunction and 80-day cooling-off period if strikes threatened the national health and safety. The NLRB could conduct decertification elections to remove unions' bargaining rights, and unions were subject to unfair labor practice claims. Also, the NLRB was empowered to adjudicate work assignment jurisdiction over particular work assignments given to one union rather than another. These are called 10K hearings, and we will talk more about this NLRB process in our episode on jurisdiction. The impact of the Taft-Hartley Act on the construction industry was that unions were prohibited from implementing closed-shop union security provisions where all employees are required as a condition of employment to be union members. We will talk more about union security provisions like union shop and other terms used in the industry, like merit shop and open shop, in another episode. Another noteworthy impact of the Taft-Hartley Act was that it permitted states to adopt right-to-work laws, which prohibited any form of compulsory union membership in a collective bargaining agreement. Again, we will talk more about right-to-work laws in another episode, but I wanted to let you know where these terms originate from in the Taft-Hartley Act. At present, 27 states have passed right-to-work laws. The final piece of legislation that I will talk about in this labor law section is the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act of 1959, or the Landon-Griffin Act. The emphasis of the Landon-Griffin Act was to protect individual union members from the abuses of their union leadership. It guaranteed union members the right to equal participation in union affairs, freedom of speech and assembly, reasonable and uniform dues initiation fees and assessment, freedom to sue unions and their officers, and fair treatment in disciplinary cases. The Landon-Griffin Act also required annual financial disclosure reporting from the unions, standards on union trusteeship whenever a union is not acting in the best interest of its members, standards on conducting fair elections. It placed fiduciary responsibilities on union officers and disqualified convicted criminals and former communists from union leadership positions. The big impact of the Landon-Griffin Act on the construction industry was it added an amendment to the National Labor Relations Act, which was Section 8F of the Act. Section 8F was added to provide for the uniqueness of the construction industry by creating a limited exception that would allow an employer and union to enter into a pre-hire agreement with a union security clause, hiring hall provisions, and others before the project even broke ground. The circumstances in construction are that jobs are of short duration, and there is a need for employers to know their labor costs before bidding on construction projects and to have a ready source of skilled labor for quick referral. Employees need to know where and when jobs are available and what skills are needed to make a career in the construction industry. So as a result, Section 8F allows employers and unions in the construction industry only to negotiate these pre-hire agreements before the first employee is hired on the project, instead of as it is in manufacturing and service industries where unions are under Section 9A of the Act. In Section 9A, employees are required to have a show of interest in a union within a bargaining unit by the signing of authorization cards by at least one-third of employees. This would possibly lead to an NLRB-certified election, considering the majority of the employees voted to be represented by the union as an exclusive bargaining agent in an attempt to gain a labor agreement with their employer. A unique provision of these pre-hire 8F agreements is that they have union security language that require employees to join the union within 7 days after being hired, rather than within a 30-day period provided for in the Act for other industries. To come within the scope of Section 8F, an employer must be engaged primarily in the building and construction industry, and the union must be a labor organization of which building and construction employees are members. However, as it is in the rest of the Landon-Griffin Act, Section 8F cannot be construed as authorizing union security clauses in right-to-work states where such clauses are illegal. So there you have it. These are the fundamental U.S. labor laws that affect the union construction industry every day. Since the mid-1960s, there has been a great number of employment laws passed that deal with other employment issues, such as the Manpower Development and Training Act of 1962, preventing discrimination in the workplace, like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Age Discrimination and Employment Act of 1967 and the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970, to name a few. It is not my intent to cover those laws in this episode, but only to present the National Labor Relations Act and the amendments to it in 1947 with Taft-Hartley and in 1959 with Landon-Griffin. There have been numerous NLRB decisions and court cases that have defined labor law when it comes to such questions as common situs picketing and other unique legal issues facing the construction industry. I will be covering some of those decisions in future episodes. Next, we're going to talk about the hierarchy of unions and how they are structured on an operational level. Thank you. Welcome back for the final section of this episode, where I'm going to talk about the structure of the building trades unions from the international level to the regional level and local levels. But first, in the labor history section of this episode, you heard me talk about the AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department, now called NAPTU, which is short for North America's Building Trades Unions. NAPTU represents the 14 AFL-CIO unions that are historically the building and construction trade unions. They have a great website at naptu.org. Check it out. There is a list on the NAPTU website that names all of their 14 affiliated unions with a link to each one of their websites. Also, they have a list of all the state and individual building trades councils throughout the U.S. and Canada with their leadership and contact information. If you don't have time to check out the NAPTU website right now, I'm just going to read down this list of the affiliated unions, which is in no particular order. Number one, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, website ibew.org. Number two, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, website teamsters.org. Number three, International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Craft Workers, website bacweb.org. And number four, the International Union of Elevator Constructors, website iuec.org. Number five, International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, website iupat.org. Number six, Labor's International Union of North America, website liuna.org. Number seven, Operative Plasters and Cement Masons International Association, website opcmia.org. Number eight, International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers, website smart-union.org. And number nine, United Association of Union Plumbers, Fitters, Welders, and Service Techs, website ua.org. Number 10, United Union of Roofers, Waterproofers, and Allied Workers, website unionroofers.com. Number 11, International Union of Operating Engineers, website iuoe.org. Number 12, the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Ship Makers, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers, website boilermakers.org. Number 13, International Association of Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers, website insulators.org. And number 14, the International Association of Bridge Structural, Ornamental, and Reinforcing Ironworkers, website ironworkers.org. All of these international unions have affiliates in Canada. However, the headquarters of each union is in the greater Washington, D.C. area, with the exception of the Boilermakers that are headquartered in Kansas City. I named all of the 14 AFL-CIO Building Trades affiliated international unions for a reason. If you were listening closely, you might have thought that one very important and historic building trades international union is missing from the NAPTU list. Can you guess who? Yes, it's the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America. Website www.carpenters.org. The Carpenters disaffiliated from the AFL-CIO in 2001, citing complaints about the National Federation's failure to follow up on its program to organize the unorganized. Although UBC has been disaffiliated from the AFL-CIO and NAPTU for over 20 years now, they still participate in national agreements and send representatives to NAPTU meetings and conferences. There exists a cordial working relationship between all the international unions and the UBC from the early 1900s to today, with some notable bumps in the roads in between. Let's talk about the building trades councils. The state and province building trades councils are the next layer of structure under NABTU on the organization chart. The state building trades councils include one for every state, district, and some U.S. territories. That comes to a total of 54 for the U.S. and 11 provincial building trades councils in Canada, for the grand total of 65 councils under the NABTU structure. The next layer down under the state councils are the regional, city, and county building trade councils. By my count, there are over 250 of these building trades councils in North America. They are all listed on the NABTU website very conveniently under the official council directory tab. If you ever need to know where the closest building trades council is for your upcoming construction project, this is the place to go. Keep in mind these local councils will have a full complement of local building trades unions that are their affiliate members. The councils will have an elected president and secretary treasurer at a minimum, which are generally representatives of one of the affiliated unions. Some councils may have a paid business manager that could be a local union business rep or even an attorney. The council presidents have the job of keeping close watch on the building activity in their geographical area. They do this by following building permit applications and contacting the developers before their projects break ground. Most present on their mind is to get a commitment from the developer or owner to build using a union workforce, either by having their contractors sign local labor agreements or bargain as a group for a PLA, a project labor agreement. Contacting the local building trades council president is a good first step for a contractor that has decided to build the project using union shop workforce. The council presidents can provide contact information for all other affiliated local unions in their council and perhaps even the wage and benefits being paid for each local union. We will talk more about local collective bargaining agreements and project labor agreements in a future episode. The local unions that are the members of the council will differ in their geographical area they each cover depending upon their trade. Some local unions, like the operating engineers or boilermakers, may have a statewide jurisdiction which may span several building trades councils, and some others, like the electricians and laborers, will have a narrower jurisdiction, maybe just county lines or to city boundaries. Now let's talk about union democracy. The general president of the unions are elected by the delegates of their convention, usually held every 4 years. The general president, or GP for short, runs with a slate of officers that he has selected, and usually the voting is almost always unanimous in accepting the entire slate. When a GP announces retirement, he will usually select his proposed successor, most likely already an officer, and that person will most likely be voted in at the next convention with the GP's full endorsement. I know this does not sound very democratic, however, this is the process for over many years and keeps the leadership mostly static and stable. Elections are also held at the local union level, again with the highest ranking officer being a business manager, running with a slate of candidates for office positions. The local union elections are far less predictable than the international elections, and incumbents are likely to be voted out if their performance in office is controversial, such as losing a jurisdictional dispute to another union, or a loss of market share, or even accusations of corruption. As I mentioned in the labor law section, local union elections can be audited by the National Labor Relations Board under the Lanham Griffin Act. Once a local union president is elected in a fair process, the board will give that local business manager a great deal of deference when it comes to claims made against the local union on the basis that the democratic will of the membership in the election of their chief officer should be honored. The board usually shows less deference to union leaders that are appointed. What happens in the local union hall? A great number of positive things like recruitment and apprenticeship training, hiring hall referrals, contract negotiations with employer groups, and health and pension benefit administration. Also, local unions conduct monthly membership meetings where the leadership can be held accountable for their administration. All contracts negotiated by the officers with their employer groups must have a ratification vote by the membership. wage increases that result from bargaining can be redistributed at the membership ratification meeting to health and welfare, pension, or training to keep a certain maintenance level of benefits. This can result in less going for a wage increase in the paycheck, but overall, it preserves the effectiveness of the local union to serve all of its members. To sum up this episode, the big takeaways are that unions in the building trades have been around for a long time and have had to struggle and fight for their legitimate place in the law, in the economy, and in society. Although union membership rose during the war years in the early parts of the 20th century and receded in the 1980s through the present day, they are still a force to be reckoned with in the construction industry and will be for many years to come. This episode, covering their history, legal foundation, and structure, is a good foundation for anyone that wants to learn more about unions in the construction industry and become more informed on how to be an effective leader in this unique work environment. So thank you for listening to this podcast episode number one on the building trades history, labor law, and union structure. Come back for the episode two that will cover union jurisdiction and work practices. Until then, be safe and be kind. References for this episode came from the book Skilled Hands, Strong Spirit by Grace Palladino, Cornell University Press, 2005. From the book, From the Folks Who Brought You the Weekend, Priscilla Morlow, A.B. Chitney, The New Press, New York, 2001. The book, Labor Relations and Social Problems, Unionization and Collective Bargaining, Herbert Sherbert, William P. Murphy, Earl M. Lycan, B&A Books, 1974, and a paper, The Examination of Section 8F of the NLRA by Missy Walrath, Villanova University, 1979. I'm Chuck Seckinger, Principal Consultant with Labor Relations Gigs. You can find more episodes at www.laborrelationgigs.com. Thank you for listening. Bye.